Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Mac and Joe Talk on a Podcast. We are recording this episode on Monday, August 14th. This episode will be released on Monday, August 15th. And you know what that means, Joe? It is the first day of CineQuest. So happy CineQuest to everyone that's going. Of course, you heard Joe here. Of course, I'm always happy to be joined by Joe with his knowledge and expertise. On all none subjects.
None of those things apply to me, but that's okay.
That's not true.
It is good to be here also, and thanks for having me, buddy. Yeah, as Mac mentioned, we do want to give another shout-out to CineQuest. If you haven't gotten your tickets, there should be some individual tickets available.
There are still some. There are limited tickets. There are limited passes available, but there are tickets for single films,
individual
if you want to do
shows,
that,
yeah.
Go to cinequest.org. Again, August 15th through the 30th in San Jose and in Mountain View, so it splits up. Overall, I've been kind of looking at the calendar and my calendar. I think I'm seeing like 15 or 16 films. Like when this thing happens, I just kind of dive in and just kind of experience it. You know, some of you guys have kind of asked for, what do you think I'm going to see? And I could post kind of things what I'm going to see, but again, a lot of this stuff is really just one or two sentences, and works with my schedule. I'm going to go check it out. One thing that really stood out to me was the documentary on Sunday, August 27th at 8:45 in Mountain View. It's called Star Wars Kid: The Rise of the Digital Shadow. So if anyone remembers, a long time ago,
in a galaxy far, far away.
No, very clever though. Before The Last Jedi came out, it might have been Force Awakens. There was a kid who was kind of wielding a lightsaber, and it was recording.
Okay.
And it kind of looked a little clunky, a little funky, and kind of posted it, right? And it was this kid who didn't have a ton of followers or anything like that, but it kind of struck kind of social media lightning for whatever reason.
Okay.
Initially, it was people making fun of him and stuff like that. But eventually he kind of gained kind of like this kind of mini cult following, and he kind of did it because he just really liked Star Wars, and he was kind of, you know, pretending like he was wielding a lightsaber. And now he's an adult, and he's kind of talked about kind of that experience and how he's become kind of this kind of mini cult person, right? He goes to like Star Wars Celebration and people know who he is. And so it's just kind of an interesting kind of possibly behind the scenes documentary kind of this story, and yeah, it looked interesting. But I know also I'm going to see a film called Adult Time, the first film I'm going to see, starring Michael Cera, on Wednesday. So there's lots and lots of good stuff. Joe mentioned he's going to see four, I think, really fascinating and interesting films. We'll see if he likes them. We'll see how good they are. But at least from the description, they sound interesting. I think I'll be able to check out those ones as well. It'd be good to go with him. But yeah, again, cinequest.org. Again, I know not everyone listening to this is in the Bay Area. But if you are in the Bay Area, please feel free to check it out as well. And we'll certainly let you know what you guys think. And again, you know, these independent films of today are, you know, potentially studio films of tomorrow, or these actors or directors, right? Maybe their big break is these next 2 weeks in CineQuest, right? Maybe they're seen by the right people, and maybe they're next directing a studio film, right? Who knows? So happy to check it out. We did see, let's just do some general updates stuff. Not a lot. One thing that I think is, considering the times we are in right now with the writer strike and the actor strike, and we're talking about, you know, writers being compensated fairly, and we're talking about actors wanting correct compensation in their mind for their likeness and such, right? Not just using their likeness in future projects where they're not getting compensated for. Disney has created an AI task force. Again, Disney is not the only studio that's kind of gone down this realm. Netflix, semi-famously, has tried to get background actors to sign a one-time licensing deal where basically they show up to set one time and they get kind of scanned, and then basically they could just be background actors forever. And so Netflix will never have to pay background actors ever again. But, you know, an AI task force is really just kind of about, in the minds of them, it's really about kind of assembling ideas and how to use AI, whether that's writing scripts, whether it's you know, one of the controversies of Secret Invasion is the entire title card was created by AI, right? There was no artist involved. There was no artist making that title card. It was AI kind of making it. You know, I don't know if this is a weird negotiation tactic or if Disney's serious about this. But again, you know, studios are looking, while actors and writers are looking for ways to, in their mind, get paid fairly, right, with residuals, et cetera, for their time. You know, studios are looking at ways to maybe cut even more costs. And you know, maybe AI is the way to do that. I certainly cannot pretend that I know anything near enough about AI to have a valid opinion on if this is going to be good or not. But Joe, do you want to add something to this? Or
no, I mean, I excuse me, I don't. I wouldn't say, since Max said I have knowledge and expertise, I would not say I have knowledge, extensive knowledge, nor expertise about AI. But, yeah, you did bring up an interesting point. I mean, the longer the strike goes on, you know, studios need to find a way to keep content churning. So,
right.
You know, this seems like an obvious choice.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to make do with what they can. And who knows? I mean, this, you know, I'm not saying this is a brilliant strategy. I don't know about the quality of this kind of thing. But, you know, who knows? We may not see the writers get exactly what they want. So who knows? This may tip the negotiation in the studio's favor. If more than one studio is doing this, and it's actually a decent quality, I have no idea if it will or won't. But, you know, I feel like they're going to try to do what they can do in the time being. Like, we're talking, it's been 6 months or so. How long has the strike been going on?
It's a couple months,
okay,
I think.
A couple months. Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah, no, June.
But it seems like there's not a lot of new things coming out already anyway.
Right.
So it's like it's only going to get worse in terms of not new content.
Yeah, there's a point for
so
sure.
So I feel like this is an alternative route. I mean, it's...
Right.
I'm not saying it's a good route. Who knows? But, you know, we talk about businesses trying to figure out ways to keep the business going. They're trying to find out new, not an entrepreneur, but an innovative ways of keeping the business running. And as you say, cutting costs, this could be it. And
right.
This may be the beginning of it. Who knows? So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I was talking to somebody over the weekend or just this past weekend who kind of works in AI, not a programmer or engineer of sorts, but he was sharing some of his experiences with AI. We'll see if that's going to be something that's going to be working in the long run, because it, not to dive into details or go off on a crazy tangent, but it was his opinion that he was skeptical that this is something that's going to be able to be sustained in the long run. So
right,
we'll have to see. I mean, this may be a short-term fix for Disney, who knows? But
yeah,
in any event, they're trying to make do and keep new content churning. And that was certainly a reason that was mentioned anyway as to why the writers were going on strike, is that it may have already been going on.
Right.
You know, in other studios. So
yeah,
who knows?
Yeah, for sure. I
vaguely remember hearing that.
It's
as
been
a,
brought up
as a grievance.
You know, if you're a studio, right, instead of paying, you know, writers every time a show is aired or streamed, they, in theory, they could, you know, maybe have one or two writers that kind of shape a story, and then you have AI writers who are using Chat GPT or kind of whatever to kind of build the story around it. Who knows?
Have you used Chat GPT?
I haven't. I wouldn't even know how to do it.
Okay.
I'd have to figure it out, but I've not done it though. I don't do enough important stuff to where I have to multitask. Like, I'm like millions of things behind where I need someone else to type my emails. Wonder Woman 3.
Just for curiosity's sake.
Oh, no, I'm not that curious.
It's like asking Siri questions.
I randomly ask Siri questions.
Just for fun stuff.
nothing about ChatGPT. Okay. I randomly asked Siri questions like, how many people live in wherever? Things like random things like that.
Well, I don't know why. But just like when obviously Siri and Alexa were coming out, like when they were first being released to market, it was like a fun thing to ask them questions. You know, for example, like asking Siri, like, hey, should I buy a Windows phone or should I buy a Droid? You know, like, and see the kind of reaction that because it's funny, you know?
Right.
So because it was more of a silly thing to do, I was just curious if you'd actually tried something. Yeah, but you haven't, that's okay. Really. Neither have I. Anyway.
Last week we got word that Gal Gadot has had a meeting with James Gunn and Peter Safran, said that Wonder Woman 3 is in development, and now there's word coming directly from DC and James Gunn saying that Wonder Woman 3 is not in the works at DC. This DC kind of transition has been weird, right? We talk about the release of The Flash and kind of how they promoted it and how it was going to be a part of the new DC if it did well, how it wasn't, right? We're going to get the same kind of reaction with Blue Beetle next week, right? If Blue Beetle is amazing, then of course they're going to keep it, right? They still have Aquaman 2 coming out. I don't want to be like Gal Gadot's lying. Like that's a weird thing to say. And maybe she had a meeting and maybe, you know, the conversation was, hey, we'll possibly keep it open in the future. I mean, I don't know if you bring in James Gunn to restart a continuity or restart a universe, whether you want a shared universe or not as a fan or whatever, like if Warner Brothers is hiring you to do this, why would you keep Zack Snyder's people in the... You know what I mean? It just doesn't make sense. Like, if we're going to do it, just do it. Right? You've already cut your losses with Ben Affleck and Henry Cavill. So is literally everyone going to stay on besides Henry Cavill and Ben Affleck? That's just kind of weird.
Yeah. They brought in James Gunn to, quote-unquote, reload DC.
Right. I mean, I just
don't... You know,
don't...
but now they're just shooting blanks. You know what I mean?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I don't have a response to it. I get it. It's very clever.
Yeah.
Was that off the top?
I was thinking about it just now.
That was very clever, Joe. You should do stand-up.
That you can add that to my credentials at the beginning of the pod. In any event, yeah, it's a little bit of speculating, a little bit of rumor mill.
Again, if you're Warner Brothers DC and you have a film coming out this week in Blue Beetle. Why are you getting headlines about Gal Gadot and Wonder Woman? Like, your headlines should be about...
If they had a choice? DC said, hey, here's Gal Gadot. She has some interesting things to tell you.
Right.
Don't worry.
But
we'll
where is she
her.
Getting this information from? Is she just making it up?
No, like, but you can't blame DC that Wonder Woman is
sure,
in the
headlines
for Gal Gadot.
You don't want to blame DC, I guess, but if you're a DC, like, all you want the focus on to be is Blue Beetle coming
but
out.
But I'm just saying,
and it's like, again, you're now getting another negative headline, right? The negative headline around The Flash is The Flash is going to lose money, right? So now, you know, it's just...
Whatever.
Again, yes, I get it. Whatever. It's not important to everybody.
No,
I understand.
No, I do.
I get it.
It just seems like a little bit of a non-story is all.
Okay.
Like, I just question the DC's, it's quote-unquote DC's fault that Gal Gadot is saying, not saying she's making it up, but it's like, I don't know.
It's
maybe
just, why,
maybe,
where is she
maybe,
getting this information?
Maybe
what's
the media
purpose?
Was asking her. So you could say maybe it's the media for wanting, because everybody likes, obviously, Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman. So maybe they were asking her. Maybe she's on some red carpet somewhere, or she's doing something, and people were just asking her Wonder Woman.
Right, but
like,
she specifically said she had a meeting with James Gunn, and they said Wonder Woman 3 is in development.
Well, perhaps James Gunn should have said, don't say anything.
I mean, I don't know. That's the point where it's like,
whatever.
She was given this information, or she's making it up. Or James Gunn is making up his... you know what I mean? Who knows? Again,
shady.
It's just weird
shady
that
acres is going
these
on.
Little kind of things constantly come out from DC. This kind of little infighting or kind of misleading lines. So we'll see. The Emmys have been officially delayed from September to January 2024. Again, it's a tentative January date. The Oscars are not till March, so again, they're hoping that the writer's strike is done. But again, this is basically because, one, actors will not appear because they cannot be there to promote or do things like that. But also, of course, you need writers to write the show. And, you know, right now you don't have any writers to write the show. So,
ChatGPT and AI Task Force. There you go.
That would be a brutal... I mean, not brutal.
How did you know that?
I just mean it would be disliked by a lot of people. But it could be great. Again, I'm not saying I wouldn't know. But I'm sure it would get roasted by people because that's what they do.
Sure.
We did see a film last week. We saw a special sneak peek of Gran Turismo, the latest Neil Blomkamp film. I think we both have some thoughts. I can go first.
Sure.
I thought it was okay. I liked it better than I thought I would, I think. I enjoyed large portions of it. I really like how they integrated the video game into the game in the sense of...
Integrated the video game into the game?
Into the movie, thank
okay,
you.
Okay.
That's why you're here.
Yeah.
To do right, a, even when they were
to
like...
correct all the...
Yes.
All the grammar.
Here's the English major. Like when one of the drivers is driving, like all of a sudden it popped up on the screen what place
yes.
they're in, or
yes.
right when they're driving it shows the path on the track.
Yes.
Like again,
yeah.
that I thought was cool.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Again, where, you know, the graphics and the special effects is like he's driving, you know, at home and then all of a sudden like the car gets built around him. Like
mm-hmm.
I thought those graphics were cool, that uniqueness was cool.
Okay.
I like that this wasn't a kind of video game adaptation, like it was a real story, you know what I mean? Like it wasn't like here's Gran Turismo and we're just gonna make up, you know, a story around the video game. Like this was kind of a real story that was happening. I thought the performances were a little uneven. David Harbour stands out again. He passionate about the role, kind of the tough guy in the beginning where he kind of has a lot of good lines and he's kind of the smart ass, but again, the more to make it like an onion, right? Like Shrek, like the layers you peel back, like the more you get to know him,
Shrek.
And the more you see, because that's it's just peeling layers back of an onion.
What does that have to do with Shrek?
That's what the line is in Shrek.
Oh.
I thought the lead actor was okay. I didn't think it was a great performance. I saw certain things, like the romance he had was a little forced, like it was a little like he saw this person one time, then all of a sudden he doesn't see her for, you know, 6 months, 8 months, whatever it is, and all of a sudden they're dating. Like we didn't really see them have a connection. I thought Jimon Hansu and Jerry Halliwell as the parents were good, but again, we didn't get to see a lot of their relationship, right? We didn't get to see a lot of his relationship with his brother. Like, you know, kind of in the first 20 minutes, he's already off to 15 minutes, he's already off kind of racing and training. Like, we didn't really get to see a lot of those relationships forming. So when there's kind of touching scenes or moments, that impact wasn't as strong for me because I didn't really, you know, like, he had talked to this girl, like, one time. Like, kind of this entire time. And all of a sudden, I'm supposed to feel like this is some crazy love story when they're in Japan. Like, I just didn't really buy it. Like, they weren't really together. Orlando Bloom, I thought I actually like Orlando Bloom. I you know, I'm always going to be partial to him, just because he's Orlando Bloom. And you know, there were some times where he was a little uneven. I thought it's mostly because his character was a little uneven, right? I didn't know if he was supposed to kind of be like to represent the suits and kind of represent kind of the bad, right? Where it's like David Harbour represents the sport and racing and the pureness, and Orlando Bloom is supposed to represent like the corporations, like, because he kind of straddled that line for a minute, but then he kind of gave really positive lines at times, and then he was kind of, you know, so I was really kind of unsure to kind of where his character was supposed to be in the film, but I thought the racing was cool for the most part. I enjoyed having them on the track. I can't say I'm a big Formula One person now, but I do know the races. I do know the tracks they race on. I do watch the F1 show on Netflix, so I have a deeper appreciation for the sport and kind of what goes into it. And these guys are really, you know, world-class athletes. Right. And they're kind of what they're doing is incredible, an athletic achievement. These are some of the best athletes in the world. So again, the Joe's kind of shrugging his head, which is fine, I guess. But yeah, I appreciate some of the best athletes in the world. Okay. So yeah, I enjoy lots of parts of it. I think it's a recommendation. Like I'm glad I saw it. But I'm not going to write this home and say this is going to be a top 10 film for me this year. But I know Joe liked it, I think. I'm not sure. Maybe, you know, we haven't talked about it since Friday. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts, Joe. So go ahead.
I liked it. I didn't love it. I agree with Max. I concur with Max's opinion that... And that I think that David Harbour was the best part of this film. He was great. I love what he brings to all of his characters. You could say that it's a similar demeanor in Stranger Things and in this movie, and I'm sure in the Hellboy remake. He just kind of has, yeah, the smart-ass, sarcastic, dry humor. You know, the smirk on his face, or the, you know, the half smile. You know, he steals the show whenever he's on screen.
Yeah, for sure.
I wasn't, you know, mind blown by the graphics in terms of like incorporating the cars. I mean, I could see that, how it kind of made sense, but I didn't really see how that was connected to the game versus the real race, because that would make sense if he was actually building the car, but he wasn't. He's literally just driving in a video game, and then he's driving in real life.
Yeah.
So I didn't really get the connection between like trying to morph some, you know, sitting on his gaming chair in his room, and then he magically like showing all the car parts coming together. Like, I just...
Got it. That makes sense.
That didn't make... Like, I understood what they were trying to do, but I didn't feel I needed to see that, like, 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
I understand what they were trying to do. I didn't... I think Orlando Bloom's character fell flat. I agree with you. You know, you brought up that point after we watched the movie about how he's kind of flip-flopping, like, you're not too sure if he's a good guy or if he's a bad guy in terms of... He's just doing this for the money or for the notoriety,
yeah.
You know, to get himself a bonus or whatever, put himself on the map. But then, like, yeah, it's like he kind of flip-flops back and forth. I thought the racer, the guy who played the main guy, I thought he did a good job. I mean, I liked him. I wasn't so much hung up on the love interest in terms of, like, that tripped me up. Like, I felt like they alluded that they had met before.
Well, they met. We saw,
no,
you saw them.
No,
meet.
No, but what I'm saying is they alluded to the fact that they kind of had some sort of a connection prior to them meeting under the bridge.
Okay.
That was the impression I got when his younger brother or older brother, I don't know.
Younger, yeah.
Younger brother is wants him to sneak out the room because so-and-so is going to be there. So I think they kind of had something, or that it was alluded to. Again, I can understand that may not be enough to satisfy the whole Tokyo trip and this and that. Fair enough. But I didn't get caught up on that, but I can understand your opinion.
Okay.
I would say I found it to be kind of intense at times. You know, there's obviously some intense scenes without spoiling the movie. You know, movies, parts where you go, oh crap, like, you know, I would say that it's kind of a somewhat of a cross between Ford versus Ferrari and Rush, in that it is kind of like a competition between two rival racers. It doesn't have the same, you know, intensity of Rush, nor does it have the same, you know, car car manufacturer and driver, like Ford versus Ferrari, but they obviously, a big portion of the movie takes place when they're doing the 24-hour Le Mans. So you obviously get a similar type setting. So it was kind of nice to see the familiarity. I think you said you had looked it up, and I because I asked you about this, I didn't know if it was Formula One. I think you had looked it up, and it's like Formula Three, right? Yeah. So this was, and again, this based off of a true story, so it was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I remember hearing vaguely about this when the story came out, but I'm not big into racing, so it really didn't speak to me.
Okay.
Per se, but I mean, I thought it was worth a watch. I mean, I thought it was in a similar vein as other Neil Blomkamp, if I'm saying that right, movies.
Yeah. Okay.
Obviously, it's not on the same. It's more of like an Elysium rather than like a District 9.
Okay.
So in terms of like it's good, not great. Would I give it a thumbs up? Sure. Would you give it a thumbs up or thumbs down?
I'll give it a thumbs up. I mean, it's not a bad movie by any stretch. Okay. I can't say that I loved it.
Yes.
But it's not a bad movie by any stretch. True. It's very well shot. It's good. It's good enough. Recommendations. I wrote a few things down. I'll just go ahead and give kind of my recommendations. And if Joe has any at the end, he can give some. But I know you guys kind of missed this segment where we've done recommendations. So I thought I'd bring it back, a film that took me a while to see that I had gotten through. Darren Aronofsky's The Whale. I finally got around to it. Brendan Fraser, of course, won the Oscar for Best Actor. It's a tough watch to get through, right? It's a very kind of sad story. There is not really kind of tons of upbeat moments. It's really kind of a 4 or 5-person cast. Brendan Fraser is, he's heartbreaking, right, the entire time. Sadie Sink is good. Again, she's, to me, one of the standouts on Stranger Things. I think she's so good on Stranger Things. For her to kind of do something else, so stretch her acting roles kind of a little bit more. Really, this is about someone who, forget the weight problem of his life. Like, he's someone who's basically lost everything in his life, right? He's lost his wife, he's lost his partner, he's lost his daughter, he's lost his health. And, how do you get up and go to just not live your life, but how do you get up and go the next day, right? And he's dealing with kind of everything. Food, in a certain sense, kind of took over his life as depression built, and he didn't know how to cope with his feelings. He didn't have a friend to talk about his feelings, and where he felt like he was inadequate of help. He felt like he was inadequate of being loved. And really, this is just heartbreaking. All right, and to see this person who lives alone, who he teaches like an online class, but as an English teacher, but he doesn't show his face on the Zoom camera. Right, his face is, his camera's always turned off because he's embarrassed of his students seeing him. Right, there is an allegory throughout where Moby Dick is his favorite story, obviously, which is where the title The Whale comes from. And that kind of pops up several times throughout the story, which I didn't get at first why the whale was that. I didn't know if it was just a weight thing or not. But then it kind of pops up. I'm like, oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Right.
Very cool.
And again, Darren Aronofsky, writes films that are challenging at times. Right. Black Swan, I think, is a beautiful film to watch. Yeah. I like Black Swan, but I can't rewatch Black Swan a lot. Like, it's just a tough watch to get through.
At times,
yeah, but it doesn't take away from the beautifulness of the film. Brendan Fraser is obviously good in it. He's very committed to the part. He's heartbreaking just looking at him. I'm not going to say that
he has a sad look about
him. Yeah, I mean, he's just...
if he doesn't say anything.
He's a sad character, right? And in some ways, you feel bad for him. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the best performance of the year last year, but I can see why he won a bunch of awards. I can see why the film was nominated. Again, I don't know if it would have made my top 10 last year. But I'm glad I finally saw it. Cool. I think it's worth it seeing it at least once.
Good.
There's that.
Great.
A book that I read, finally got around to reading, is called Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon. It's by James Hibbard. I got this book a while ago, and I finally just got around to it. James Hibbard is an entertainment reporter, and he has written for various outlets and things like that. The reason why he kind of wrote this book or kind of compiled this book is he, on one of his first assignments for a company that he was working for at the time, he got sent out to kind of go behind the scenes of the pilot of Game of Thrones. Again, at this point, it was... a lot of people thought it was going to be the most expensive failure HBO had ever done. And they were, you know, HBO was known for shows like The Sopranos and The Wire and, you know, Deadwood and these kind of really intense dramas. It wasn't known for like sci-fi fantasy and,
yeah,
you know, kind of these things. And you know, how they all, I mean, there's so many types of little stories about how they had to recast several roles, including Daenerys in the pilot. How Emilia Clarke basically walked on as her first kind of film role. How Kit Harington had just graduated school and he had one West End credit, and that's the role that he got after his first film role, his first on-screen role. You know, talked about kind of the relationship between George R. R. Martin and David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, and how George R. R. Martin kind of laid a groundwork, but at a certain point, you know, Weiss and Benioff kind of went their own route and kind of chose their own ending. And you get lots of quotes and lots of excerpts from Martin about how he wouldn't have done it this way and wait till my book comes out. And right, it's, you know, it's not an animosity thing, but it's a, you know, when you're creating a TV show kind of with an end date and a kind of production budget realization, you have to cut out a lot of things and you have to kind of trim the story to a certain extent and kind of focus on certain characters. But also how they added characters to the story. Like, Sansa is not a character in the book. Like, they added Sansa the character. And so for Sansa to be basically one of the main characters throughout the entire series is pretty incredible. So again, it's, as someone who loved the series, I watched it in real time. I rewatched it with Joe. I absolutely love the series. It makes me want to rewatch the series again. I'm not going to start it anytime soon or anything like that. But I think it's such a good... such a good series, and you know, it makes me appreciate reading the book. Makes me appreciate everything that goes along with the series, the difficulties it is to kind of film in these countries in these locations. Right, they talked about how the battle at Winterfell when they're going against the dead, how it was like 55 nights in a row where they shot. It was the longest sequence of one single fight in, you know, film, TV, on-screen history, right? The previous before was like Helm's Deep and Two Towers, right? But this had like basically doubled it, right? How it was just this massive like undertaking and, you know, kind of all these things. And it's just, you know, how expensive the show was. But I mean, how much money in theory the show made for HBO with subscriptions, but with not just subscriptions, but licensing, right? All these things and appearances and how it spun off, you know, spin-offs and a concert series and kind of all these things. And right now HBO is doing, you know, a little, right, they did His Dark Materials. They've done kind of other shows kind of in that genre in part because of Game of Thrones. And so, you know, it's a really kind of incredible story. So check it out, Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon by James Hibbard. I also want to give one quick shout-out. I realized as I was kind of just looking up stuff, this past week actually is the 15th anniversary of Tropic Thunder. I think it's a kind of an uncovered, not undiscovered gem, but it's certainly not something that's always on the tip of people's tongues when they talk about comedies. So the 15th anniversary is actually this past week of Tropic Thunder, which was directed by Ben Stiller. It got Robert Downey Jr. An Oscar nomination. And again, this was kind of when Robert Downey Jr. was really kind of doing a renaissance, right? He had done Zodiac, then he did Iron Man, and then he did this. And so, again, this was kind of the renaissance of Robert Downey Jr. Certainly has controversies for several different reasons throughout the film. But I enjoy the film. I think it's worth a watch. So, did you want to add any recommendations?
Yeah, I have one. I finished this book a little bit ago. I want to say about a month ago. It's a very... it's a book. It's the book. The name of the book is called Falling, and it's written by an author named T.J. Newman. And a little bit of... Now, this may not be a book that you've heard of, which is fine, I remember stumbling upon this book on like some random website where it was like the top 10 books you need to read this summer or something like that. This book originally came out in 2021. The paperback version came out in April of this year, so it's in paperback. You can save some money. TJ Newman is actually a former flight attendant. She is a woman. Even though, yeah, she just abbreviated. I guess her name is TJ, probably, because I guess in somehow or other it gets more printing and people may overlook books if it's written by a female for whatever reason. I don't know.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I've just heard that. In any event, she was a former flight attendant. And this book it's a novel and it is fictitious, but it is an intense action, suspenseful story. The premise of the story, and this really doesn't give away the story because it kind of tells you on the synopsis on the back cover, is there is a pilot him and his co-pilot are flying a plane from, I want to say, like San Francisco or L.A. I think it's L.A. L.A. to New York, something like that. And when he gets, like, the premise of the book is there's a terrorist who basically holds the captain's family hostage and is threatening to kill his family if he doesn't crash the plane.
Okay.
So that's the whole premise of the movie, of the book.
Okay.
I think it's going to be made into a movie because it's the New York Times bestseller. I meant to write down on the many pages it is, but it's a quick read. I don't read fast, but it's a pretty intense story, and it's gotten a lot of notoriety from authors like James Patterson and such, because it's a really intense story. You kind of don't want to put it down. The chapters are, you know, it feels like it ends at like a cliffhanger, so you want to keep reading at the end of each chapter. Even though this was this T.J. Newman's first book, it's great. Again, it's just a great page turner. So if you're looking for an interesting action-packed, you know, thriller story, check it out. It's called Falling by T.J. Newman.
Great. Thank you for that recommendation.
Although it might make you not want to fly, so.
Okay. Just don't read it on an airplane.
Yeah, don't read it on an airplane.
We're going to do a rankings top five Will Ferrell performances. I tried to distinguish between performances and films. The reason why I chose, I know this is not Joe's favorite ranking.
Differentiate performances? What do you mean?
Performances of Will Ferrell versus the film. Again, you could, obviously it kind of combines at certain points.
You're saying like,
the performance of Will Ferrell versus the film overall. So maybe you don't like the film, but you like the performance. Right? It's not top five Will performances.
I know.
Will Ferrell does have a film coming out this week. This upcoming week, Strays, where he voices a dog, along with Jamie Foxx. So that's the reason why we're doing Will Ferrell performances. I know we did comedies a few weeks ago, so some of these are, at least on my list, are going to pop right back up as well.
Yep.
But I think it could be fun. Joe, I can go first, or you can go first.
I'll go first.
All right.
For me, again, I'm glad we did five because I don't have a ton. But these, I think, are his best, I think, funniest performances. Number five for me, again, the movie isn't all that great, but it is so incredibly, silly, goofy, zany. Like, I remember in the trailer that, like, the trailer gives, like, the one line that, like, is probably the best line in the film. The film is, in and of itself, isn't all that great, but again, Will Ferrell is the best part in the film. his co-star is Bill Hader, and this is Blades of Glory.
What's the line?
He goes, "We're going to skate to one song only. My humps, Mahomes. And then Bill Hader goes, no, don't
Bill
sing
Hader,
that.
It's the John Heater, the
John
guy from,
Heater. Sorry, not
the guy
Bill
from
Hader.
Napoleon Dynamite.
Excuse me. I don't remember
okay.
his name because he obviously doesn't make movies anymore.
Well, he's still
in any John Heater, is that his name?
Yeah, John
okay.
Heater, yeah.
John Heater, yes, the guy from the Point Dying. He's just like, why are we doing that song? It's provocative. It gets the people going. and of course, that line is also in a Jay-Z song. So every time I hear that Jay-Z song, I think of Will Ferrell. Blaze
nice.
Of Glory.
Number five is Zoolander. He plays Mugatu, the fashion designer. This is only his second film performance, or his third, excuse me. It was after A Night at the Roxbury. This is when he was still on Saturday Night Live. So I think Ben Stiller, you know, took a chance on him, kind of plays this over-the-top fashion designer who's the bad guy. Again, he's so over-the-top that it's funny to a certain extent. And again, I think he steals a lot of the scenes that he's in, including a very funny Ben Stiller. Again, a very small performance, right? The film is Ben Stiller's film, but I think he's great when he's in it. So, Zoolander, number five.
For me, number four, I've mentioned this previously in the comedies. It's more of a duo. A lot of these movies, he's kind of either a duo. There's very few where he's kind of the lone guy. But this is also a duo with Mark Wahlberg. The juxtaposition is very, very funny between him kind of being like a straight arrow and Mark Wahlberg kind of being like the guy who wants to go off and do crazy things and, you know, he's reluctant to do so. He plays a very different character than I think he usually does. Like, normally he's like the outlandish guy who's goofy and silly and doing all of these, you know, being loud and obnoxious and, you know, very silly. Like, he's silly in this role, but he's doing it in a serious way. Like, and that's why I think it's a unique type of role for him. Mark Wahlberg is the one that's kind of doing like all, you know, like making fun of him the whole time. So it's a nice yin and yang. I feel so. Yeah, Mac knows what movie this is. The number four, The Other Guys.
That scene in the movie with Eva Mendes is so funny.
Yeah,
it's a great scene.
Yeah. Is that the dinner table?
Yeah, where Mark Wahlberg cannot comprehend
yes,
why
yes,
she's married.
Yes,
to him.
That's what makes it funny. That's what makes the whole movie because he's such a straight arrow. Because
Gator gets what he wants.
Yes.
Number four is Elf. I understand that it's a Christmas movie. I understand there, you know, you're not. There has to be some suspense of belief in terms of, you know, there's Santa Claus and there's elves and things like that. But I think really what makes the film good and touching and kind of holiday spirit is because of literally the spirit of Buddy the Elf and how he's a good guy. And he's kind of this in a weird situation where he kind of got raised by elves. And right. Again, it's suspense of disbelief. But you genuinely root for him as a character. Right? You know, he's a good guy. You know, he's silly and he makes mistakes and he's kind of this man-child and who eats, you know, syrup for breakfast and all these things and how he thinks he's an elf. But, like, at the end of the day, like, you care about him. Like, you root for him. He's a good person. And I think that's kind of what makes the film go. He truly has the spirit of Christmas in him all year long. And I think he's a good person. So, that comes down to Will Ferrell's performance. So, number four is Elf.
For me, I don't own this movie. There are very few movies that he's in that I own. This is not one of them, but I don't feel you can mention a list of top five Will Ferrell performances without including this film. Now that Mac was kind of sharing movies and such, this obviously was not his first role, but I think you could make the argument that this put him on the map. Even though he's not, I don't want to say a side character. He's more of like, it is an ensemble cast, but he's one of the highlights, if not the bright highlight. In an otherwise, I think it's an okay film. I never bought the hype into the film. People were saying it was like the funniest movie ever. I thought it was okay. But like maybe it's because everyone thought it was like the best thing since sliced bread, and I was like, okay, this wasn't that funny. But his performance was
show has to go against
his performance.
The grain.
His performance was very, very funny. I just didn't find it all that funny. But Will Ferrell was definitely the highlight in this film. I love you, my boy Blue. Old School, number three.
Okay. Number three is Step Brothers. Again, it's a very much a two-person, two-hander type of a film, right? Again, Will Ferrell's character works because he's paired up with John C. Reilly, right? The two of them together are obviously very good. But again, Will Ferrell has his moments, right? They're both kind of man children to a certain extent, right? You see kind of a common theme going through the characters he plays, right? Kind of a funny kind of man-child adult, which he's very good at. But again, you just funny lines throughout. Step Brothers for me is number three.
Number two, again, this one's higher for me than Mac, which is fine. I put this movie at number two because, again, if Old School is not what he is known for, then this movie surely is. It's either one of the two. No question about it. Regardless of whether it is a holiday movie or not, you cannot say Will Ferrell without mentioning Elf. For all the reasons Mac mentioned, although I wouldn't say it's because I think he's a good guy and I root for him. It's more of just because he's so, again, he's very, very innocent, as you say, a man-child. He has good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And again, having the contrast between him and James Caan is nice. It adds to the story. I don't feel it would be all that great if it was just him being an elf without some sort of a family dynamic. Again, the movie I think is so-so. It's never like one of my top. It's not in my top five holiday movies. That's fine. But again, I can't deny the fact that it's a very, very funny movie, especially when he's in the mall and he's saying, Santa's come! You know, like, he's just totally, he's a very angry elf with Peter Dinklage. Like, that's like just a classic scene. So, yeah. So,
okay.
Elf.
Number two is, if you're not first, you're last. It's Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby. Again, John C. Reilly does a lot of heavy lifting here as well. For him, Sacha Baron Cohen is a really good supporter for him as well. But again, the common theme, he's kind of a grown, kind of adult man-child who says silly things, who's over the top, kind of uses racing as a metaphor for life. And when he can't win races, he kind of gets stage fright. He gets kicked out. He loses his sponsors. He has to go live with his dad. He has to go live with his mom. You know, he's kind of humbled and he kind of has to learn about himself again. But still funny. Still, just a laugh out loud movie throughout. But again, you find some heart and humor throughout. And again, you at the end of the day kind of root for him, I think. So, all right. Again, the final scene where him and Sacha Baron Cohen crash and, you know, they're out of cars, but they get out of their car and they just like run towards the finish line. And, you know, like it's an actual race. And the announcer in the film goes, well, technically, you know, neither of them won because they got out of their cars and ran. But again, just funny lines kind of throughout. And again, classic Will Ferrell. So number two is Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby.
So for me, number one is a movie, again, another movie with Mark Wahlberg. It's very, very funny. Daddy's Home. Just kidding. No, what it actually is the more cowbell skit that's on SNL. That's
okay.
His best performance.
Okay.
No, of course not.
Well, I mean,
but that's a classic.
You
one
could say
too.
Saturday Night Live. I mean, he came with a lot of great characters.
No, number one is undisputable top movie. The premise of the movie was so original. Like there was never. I mean, yes, they made a sequel to it. Fine. Haven't seen it. Don't care to. But the actual premise of the original one was so unique that hadn't been done before. Like a slapstick comedy about news anchors. And his mustache was just absolutely perfect. everything about this movie is great from start to finish, including all the things. Yeah, it's including the him being, you know, not knowing that he's making mistakes on live TV, to him being in like the zoo with the bear. Like, it's just the whole movie is just great. You know, him kind of falling from his perch and, you know, losing, you know, he's literally like walking the highway with in like shambles. He's like a homeless guy now, and it's so incredibly funny. Yes, there's some other actors and actresses in it. Christina Applegate, obviously, Steve Carell, and the rest of the news. Paul Rudd, yeah. So it's not just him,
yeah.
But he is obviously the headliner, and he is totally delivers. Yeah, it's a great, great movie. Definitely will last the test of time for sure. Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy.
Yeah, number
and
one.
And I think all of the spoofs about it too.
Yeah.
Like at one point when they were like doing trailers, like they were like doing like a spoof where like he was pretend, like he like went on like an SNL or something where he was pretending to be him, or maybe this was like after the movie came out. I don't remember. But
when he was promoting the movie.
Yeah, he was promoting the movie, and it was just so funny. Like he was on like
SportsCenter.
Yeah, he was on. Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah, he was on like SportsCenter, some talk show.
He was like 24-hour
yes.
sports. This isn't gonna catch.
Yeah,
on.
It was the funniest thing ever promoting the film. Like he's literally in character.
Yeah.
Like talking about like betting on games or something. It was the funniest thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like what great you know.
That's
you know,
promotion.
Synergy,
yeah,
cross promotion, yeah.
Number one is Anchorman. I personally think it's the role that he's most known for, that he's going to be known for. But as most of the reason that Joe said again, it's a good ensemble film. There's everyone kind of gets jokes in it here at times and kind of gets to have little moments to shine. But he is the star, right? He gets all the big moments. He gets all the big shine. Just like he's the star of the news team, he is the star of the movie. So number one is Anchorman for me. That was good, Joe. You did better than I thought you were going to do. You had a lot
I did
of...
better than I thought?
Well,
I don't know what that's supposed to mean.
Don't overthink it.
I no,
mean, like,
I just, I'm asking you
like
what
you
means.
Were, I thought you were going
to,
I thought you were going
to clarify
give,
what that means.
I thought you were going to get five, like, well, this is okay. Type of roles like you. Were,
I,
you were,
I had
you
to
were
throw
good.
In Blades of Glory.
That's
like,
a
I don't
movie.
Really care about that movie, and I just.
It's a good movie.
I wasn't gonna. It was either that, or
what other
was,
options did you have?
Or it was semi-pro, and I saw
Jackie
that movie,
Moon.
I saw that movie once, and it didn't. I thought Woody Harrelson was a better character.
Yeah.
Than him. But in any event, I'm glad I did good, Mac. Thank you. All right, so we are now wrapping things off. We didn't do this last time. We were supposed to do it, but we definitely were talking about Cinequest and other things, so we know you guys like it when we do this too. So we are ending today's pod on theme parks with, and of course, we are doing attraction history. We are going to do rides from Universal Studios Hollywood. We probably have done these before, but... these particular rides before, but that's okay because we may have some new listeners, and I think we may have done these. It's been a long time. Like, we did this, I want to say we started this 2-3 years ago. No, more than that. Gosh.
5 years ago.
5 years ago, excuse me. So we may be circling back, but be that as it may, it's always nice to kind of hear, you know, revisit these rides.
And some information's changed.
Yes, some information has changed. Maybe,
like
yeah,
that.
Maybe the ride is no longer there or whatnot.
Right.
But these are two current rides. They're both at Universal Studios Hollywood, not the one in Orlando. The one that I'm going to talk about is Revenge of the Mummy. This is a dark ride, kind of a high-speed indoor roller coaster ride, where they have fog and strobe lights and light effects and advanced animatronics. This took the place of the E.T. It opened in on June 25th, 2004. And it took the place of the E.T. ride
It's on the lower lot, right?
It's on the lower lot, yeah. So it's next to Transformers and Jurassic World, all the lower lot rides. The ride is 4 minutes long. A couple of news and notes. It has a linear induction motor to launch riders to 40 miles per hour suddenly. And that's kind of when you're doing your turns and drops and such. Inside the somewhat darkened area, there are, you know, some sort of things that are lit up. It's not as dark as, say, Space Mountain. You can kind of see where you're going when, as the track is kind of illuminated as a result of having, you know, some figures that are illuminated. So you can kind of see somewhat where you're going. But unlike Space Mountain, once you kind of get to the end of the track, that's when kind of the scarabs come out, a la Indiana Jones. But then you go backwards in reverse. So it's kind of a, you know, you get the forward and backward experience. An interesting news and notes about the ride queue. Again, I haven't been to Universal Studios in a while, but there's a Book of the Dead.
Yeah.
In the line queue, once you kind of go inside the temple.
Yeah.
That is an actual prop from the movie. So that was from the movie. Yeah. So, and this obviously ride is named after the Mummy film franchise. It opened in 2004, so I don't quite remember.
99 was the first
movie. 99 was the first movie. I think they already had the three movies at that point, but they didn't have the one with Jet Li. That one came later. So they had probably The Mummy Returns, and possibly The Scorpion King, but obviously Brendan Fraser wasn't in that, and it wasn't the Mummy character.
Right.
But yeah, it's a fun ride. I mean, it's okay.
You like it, right?
I like it. It's worth going on to get like the sudden like jolt that you don't really know is coming.
You can't really see where you're going though, right?
Like, at the beginning. I would say, yeah, it kind of starts off like you're kind of in like some gold, you know, you're surrounded by gold and treasures. Mm-hmm. And then I don't quite remember, but I know like it's suddenly like you turn a corner and then there's something like talking head is talking at you.
The mummy's talking to you.
Yeah, there's a mummy talking at you, and all of a sudden you just take off going, you know, like I said, up to 40 miles an hour. You can't see the beginning, but then once you see like little figurines and stuff that are illuminated or lit up like in neon lights, you can kind of see where the track is. It's an okay ride. I mean, it's and I would say that I know I'm talking about the one that's in Universal Studios Hollywood, but there are a few other iterations in the Universal parks around the world. Both of those are much, much longer and much different.
Okay.
Yeah. They were kind of constrained in space.
Sure.
For the Hollywood ride because they were using the same building as the E.T., but if you go to, let's say, Orlando Universal Studios and you ride the Mummy ride, it's much longer.
Okay.
And it's not the same in terms of, like, the layout. Maybe, like, the actual setup, you know, like the queue and or, like, the intro part of the ride. But the track is supposed to be different and the experience slightly different. And the ride, I should say.
Okay.
But nice. Yeah, opened in 2004 in place of ET. It's fun. It's worth going on.
Good.
Yeah. So go ahead and tell everyone what ride you're talking about.
Thank you for that, Joe. I'm not a big roller coaster guy, but I do like the Mummy though. I actually think it's a good ride.
Yeah.
I did Despicable Me Minion Mayhem at Universal Studios Hollywood. It is on the upper lot. It replaced the show T2 3D Battle Across Time.
Okay.
That was the show that it replaced. It actually first opened in Florida in 2012. It opened in Hollywood in 2014. Japan in 2017. Beijing in 2021. And it's going to open in Singapore in 2024. Again, I think this speaks to the popularity, not necessarily of the ride, but the popularity of Despicable Me and Minions kind of overall. Right? Again, yeah. I mean, these are incredibly popular animated characters. Yeah. You see Minions all over the place.
Yeah.
There is, again, it was the newest ride at the time. There's a queue where, like, you're walking through, On the outside, and you kind of, there's a TV screen, but there's also lots of little signs about, you know, becoming a minion and kind of what that means. Then the first pre-show is you're in the living room, and then you see the characters and stuff like that on the screen. And then the second pre-show, you're in the lab. Again, right, they were thinking when this ride first opened, it was going to be incredibly popular, which it was, so they needed lots of queues and pre-shows to kind of keep it going. Because it is a slow load of a ride. Right, it's a stationary motion simulator ride. It's about 4 minutes as well for this ride. And then you're basically, you put on the 3D glasses, and then you're basically just motion simulating from there, kind of like the Simpsons ride to a certain extent, although the Simpsons ride is not 3D. Right, you're just kind of going in the Simpsons ride. This, you are putting on glasses, and you're kind of going. And again, the concept of it is you're becoming a minion. Right, and so you got to kind of do all these. You've become a minion, and so now you have to kind of do these tests to kind of prove that you're a good minion, that you can do all these things. Again, there are these kind of weird, extravagant things, and of course, because you're a minion, nothing goes right. Kind of lots of things happen. You are with the girls from the film as well. All of the actors from the film reprise their roles, including Steve Carell, including Russell Brand. Russell Brand was just at Universal like a couple weeks ago. He took a picture in front with a minion, which I thought was kind of funny. He's Dr. Nefarious. He's like the guy that creates the inventions for him. But yeah, it's a good ride. It's for all ages, I think. I think anyone can enjoy it. If your body doesn't like to be shaked or kind of move side to side kind of fast, again, like the Simpsons ride for a lot of people, maybe the ride's not for you. It's kind of jerky to a certain extent, right? Think of Indiana Jones and like Disneyland, right? The ride kind of just sudden, kind of jerky movements. They are in Florida. We talked about this as well. They not only built this ride, but they built a second ride as well. It's called Villain Con, where it's like basically a shooter ride where you have this kind of, again, like a Midway Mania or Buzz Lightyear Astro Blasters or Spider-Man ride in Disney California Adventure. So there's an entire, now in Florida, there's an entire land called Minion Land as well. In Hollywood, it's
so they have bananas.
They do have bananas. Okay. But there's a couple restaurants in Hollywood. You can get like, you know, banana cake, or you can get banana smoothies or whatever. There are some things like that. Once the ride is over, you do walk through the gift shop, which again I get it. But it's, I actually think it's one of the better gift shops in Universal Studios. That's not the reason why to ride the ride. But I think it's a pretty cool gift shop to go through if you have to go through a gift shop. And it's also located adjacent right next to Super Silly Funland, which is kind of a water park and kind of a little mini kind of park that younger kids can go and enjoy themselves in. Again, Super Silly Funland in the first Despicable Me is the kind of little fair park that they go to. So again, they kind of tie it in. But again, if you have really little kids, and again, you're not riding stuff like Harry Potter or the Mummy or stuff, and you need these kids to kind of burn off some energy, you know, Super Silly Funland is a place where a lot of little kids go to. Right, because it basically is a little mini water park at that point. So your little ones can go to there. All right, guys, we will be back next week. I think we may, having said that out loud, we may take next week off just because we're watching films for CineQuest. But we'll try and keep you guys updated. As well, of course, if you're subscribed to the podcast, you'll just get the new episode whenever it downloads as well. But whenever we do come back on, we'll talk about everything we've experienced at CineQuest. We'll also look forward to September in film, TV, and streaming. We're getting some new films coming out, maybe some good ones as well. Joe, thank you for being here. Great information, as always.
And knowledge and expertise.
Yes, your knowledge and expertise is unquestioned. You are my roller coaster guy.
Okay.
It's true. Of the two of us, you're the roller coaster knowledge. As always, like, share, comment, rate, review, and subscribe. Joe's going to take us out of here.
Your love is like a roller coaster, baby, baby. I want to ride. Red Hot Chili Peppers, or a remake, roller coaster.